The UK Defence Ministry says that 7 Afghan civilians have been killed in chaos near the Kabul airport as thousands are trying to flee the country. Former U.S. President Donald Trump says that Washington's botched exit from Afghanistan is the greatest foreign policy humiliation in U.S. history. And Iran's parliament debates the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for a second day. It's good to have you with us. The British Defense Ministry has confirmed the death of 7 people amid chaos near the international airport in the Afghan capital, Kabul. It said that the deaths happened as thousands of Afghans gathered to flee after the Taliban's takeover of the country. Conditions on the ground are said to be extremely challenging. Meantime, the senior Taliban official is saying that the United States is to blame for the chaos at the airport. The official noted that the U.S. has failed to bring order to the airport. Thousands of people, including women and children, have thronged the entry gates to the Kabul airport to find a chance to leave the country. Several people have died due to heat or stampede over the past days. Now, in the meantime, the United States has urged citizens in Afghanistan to avoid traveling to Kabul airport due to what it calls potential security threats near the gates. The U.S. Embassy issued a warning without elaborating. But a White House official says that they have discussed counterterrorism operations in the country, including against Daesh terrorists. The United States and its allies are still trying to evacuate thousands of their nationals, as well as Afghans previously working for them, 6 days after the Taliban's takeover of the country. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby says that the countries are racing against time and space to evacuate people. The U.S. is seeking to evacuate 15,000 Americans and up to 60,000 Afghans. Washington has set itself a deadline of August 31st to complete the process. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has heavily criticized incumbent Joe Biden for the way he's handled the exit of American troops from Afghanistan.
Failed totally on the pandemic, and he's now overseeing the greatest foreign policy humiliation in the history of the United States of America. This is the greatest humiliation I've ever seen. Biden's botched exit in Afghanistan is the most astonishing display of gross incompetence by a nation's leader, perhaps at any time that anybody's ever seen. Name another situation like this.
Trump made a comment during a rally in Alabama. He said that the U.S. pullout has to go down in history as one of the greatest military defeats of all time, adding that it was total surrender, then a withdrawal. The former president said that a quick takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban would not have happened if he had been in office. The former president repeatedly blamed Biden for Afghanistan's fall to the Taliban. Biden, however, argues that he inherited a bad withdrawal agreement from Trump. The rapid fall of the Afghan capital Kabul has raised questions about the readiness of the country's army to put up resistance against the Taliban. And that's particularly significant as the West claims it had provided sufficient training to Afghan security forces. Russia has said, meantime, that the U.S. forces were complicit in poppy cultivation and illegal drug trafficking in Afghanistan.
The developments in Afghanistan have been making headlines for the past few days following the chaos that ensued the abrupt U.S. troops withdrawal from the country. The Taliban's meteoric rise to power and pandemonium at the Kabul airport prompted criticisms against how the U.S. pulled out its troops and also the outcome of the 20-year war on Afghanistan. Western politicians were among those expressing regret over incidents in Afghanistan, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying it appeared that all the troops killed in the war had died in vain. But that's not the only bitter legacy of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. Russia's Security Council Secretary Nikolai Petrushev has said that Washington turned a Central Asian country into a global illicit drug laboratory in the past 20 years. In an interview, the Russian security chief noted that the production of opiates in Afghanistan have increased over 40-fold during the past two decades.
Well, obviously, a lot of this was being produced during the time that the United States and the NATO forces were active in Afghanistan. And there was really never a concerted effort. There were attempts every now and then, you know, to do destroy fields and to, you know, persuade the farmers to produce, you know, corn or wheat or something like that. But it was not very successful, and it was never really a concerted effort on the part of the authorities to do that.
The Russian official added that the war crippled Afghanistan's economy, throwing it back decades.
The United States and its NATO allies invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks in New York with a declared aim of fighting terrorism. Conversely, the number of attacks in Afghanistan rose, and that significantly. And that has raised questions about billions of dollars spent and thousands of lives lost during America's longest war.
The United States has been training Afghan government forces for the past 20 years. Out of 300,000 Afghan troops, 22,000 have been commandos that Washington says have received special training. Despite that, the Taliban managed to sweep through the nation in a matter of days and seize the capital, Kabul, faster than anybody had anticipated. The rapid rate at which Afghan cities fell to the militant group also stunned Pentagon officials.
They had the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
According to Russia's security chief, Nikolai Petrushev, the West was never able to train the army, police, and security services of Afghanistan, as the number of attacks in Afghanistan have increased significantly after foreign forces were deployed to the country.
The Taliban, during the course of the time the United States was so-called in charge in Afghanistan, and really they controlled only a small part of the country. They were never in control of the entire country. Much of the Taliban influence was still making itself felt in various parts, especially in the region, some of the mountainous regions that often were inaccessible to large-scale military intervention. And the fact that that was an ongoing fight in which the Taliban were pitted against the official Afghani forces, then it seems reasonable that these would increase to the extent that they still felt themselves at war with a foreign power.
Petrushev added that the reported 40,000 civilian deaths since 2001 in Afghanistan has been understated, and that the figure doesn't include tens of thousands of Afghan troops that have been killed over the years. The Russian security official concluded that the staggering number of deaths is a result of the U.S. interference in the domestic affairs of other countries.
Now moving on, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted to the latest Israeli airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip, saying that Tel Aviv is making calculation errors. It said that Israel has clearly ignored the message from Palestinians and resistance groups by pounding Gaza hours after injuring dozens of protesters. By attacking Gaza, Hamas said that the Israeli regime is trying to reduce the intensity of its despair and failure in the face of the resistance front. Hamas underlined that Palestinians and resistance groups will counter the enemy with determination. Israeli warplanes pounded at least three targets in the besieged strip. Tel Aviv claimed that the air raids were in response to a protest marking the 52nd anniversary of the burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip commemorated the 52nd anniversary of Al-Aqsa Mosque burning by holding a huge rally along the separating border East Gaza. Al-Aqsa Mosque was burned by an extremist Jew in 1969. Palestinian factions expressed their condemnation of Israel's long history of crimes against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Today marks the 52nd anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. This incident shows the true nature of this occupation. Palestinians here vow to continue their battle against this occupation across all occupied lands. We remain united in this endless battle with all possible means.
This rally comes in conjunction with the current Israeli violations in Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli regime is imposing the policy of eviction and displacement of Palestinians and keeping their killing and land-grabbing operations in an attempt to Jewidize Al-Quds and get rid of its people.
Palestinians have gathered here to assert the unity of all Palestinians in the face of occupation. Palestinians are here to say no to any Israeli attempts to Judaize the Palestinian lands. Palestinians won't accept any violation against Al-Quds, and the resistance will go on until liberation of all Palestine.
The resistance declared it won't allow Israel to violate Palestinian sanctities and keep the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, as they agreed to activate the popular resistance and the return of clashes by the separation fence, stressing they won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes.
Palestinians have proved that they will keep their resistance in the face of all Israeli projects that aim to demolish the Palestinian identity. Al-Quds is the symbol of our history. Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque are our red lines, and we won't accept any Israeli violation of our holy sites. Israeli regime must be held accountable for any action against Al-Quds.
52 years after Al-Aqsa Mosque was set ablaze, Palestinians here call for defending Al-Quds with all possible means until its complete freedom from occupation. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The International Criminal Court has added new cases of Palestinian homes demolished by Israel to its probe into the regime's war crimes. The International Tribunal says it will review the Israeli military's razing of several structures in the village of Herbat Humsa in the occupied Jordan Valley. The cases were sent to the ICC by Israeli NGO Combatants for Peace. Former ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda opened the war crime probe into Israeli actions from 2014 and onwards. The regime's settlement construction, razing of Palestinians' homes, and military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip are among the issues under investigation. Now, political commentator Bruno Biaclini says that Israel is an apartheid regime that promotes ethnic cleansing in the region.
Rules for the international community, for the international system, that Israel, the Zionist entity, is an apartheid state. They are promoting ethnic cleansing since the earlier, the late 20s. They never said nothing different from this, and we can prove, as international studies scholars, that the state of Israel is composed majority by European invaders, who are still invading the Jordan Valley, Al-Quds, the West Bank, sieging Gaza, and also inside the occupied territories in 1948, they are promoting apartheid. I can barely imagine what would happen if it was promoted by the de Klerk regime, Peter Botha regime, in the old South African apartheid, because it's quite the same. We could say that without United States support, infinite support for Israel, they could never proceed during an apartheid regime like they are doing. But also, the most important thing is not to rely on ICC. It's important, but the most important thing is to rely on the Palestinian Arabic diaspora. For example, here in Brazil, we are 60 million people from Arab descendants who are still very vinculated to the Bilad Hasham and to liberating Palestine, securing Lebanon, and liberating Syria from the Salafist invaders.
The Iranian parliament is debating the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for a second day. MPs are reviewing the qualifications of the president's picks for ministerial posts. Supporters and opponents of the nominees are given the stage to speak for or against them. And this comes ahead of a vote of confidence expected to take place on Wednesday. The president will have up to 3 months to name a replacement in case any of the proposed ministers fails to win the vote. Raisi defended his choices before Parliament on Saturday. Addressing the legislative chamber, he said that the lineup is meant to bring justice and progress.
On Saturday, Iran's parliament began its open session differently, hosting some of the ministers-to-be and the president himself to attend the vote of confidence session. The process began after week-long behind-closed-doors deliberations on Raisi's proposed list of ministers. Based on the parliament regulations, the president is given 2.5 hours' time to introduce and defend his nominees before 5 pros and 5 cons from lawmakers speak against or in favor of the list.
The reform program pursued by the administration is the centerpiece of the proposed minister's agenda. The program is based on 5 pivotal points. First, a statement on the second step of the Islamic revolution. Second, improving Islamic and Iranian values. Third, pursuing economic resilience. Fourth, improving the livelihoods of the people, especially low-income families. Fifth, promoting international relations based on national interests.
The process will then involve the introduction of the nominated ministers one by one, and based on the Persian alphabetical order of the ministries. For each minister, 2 pros and 2 cons will speak, each for 15 minutes, before the nominees take the podium to defend their qualifications for 30 minutes. Majlis says it will work 2 shifts every day to wrap up the process swiftly.
Parliament maintains a cooperative stance toward the government. We will work 2 shifts a day to cover up to 5 nominees every day. If all goes as planned, we will hold the final session on Tuesday.
The proposed cabinet for Mr. Raisi is a combination of expertise and youthfulness. Some of them are young, but at the same time, they are experienced. With that being said, I predict that the voting process will not be lengthy.
Ebrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament 10 days ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then reviewed the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week. The open floor vote of confidence sessions are expected to run until Tuesday, when the final voting will be held for the 19 ministerial picks.
Lawmakers say in their voting they bear in mind that the proposed lineup is the team that the president wants to work with. And given Raisi's close ties with Parliament, it's expected that the majority of the nominees will win the green light to sit on the ministerial chairs. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian Parliament.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
March 18, 2002. Imam Hussein knew what would his silence, his endorsement, and his indifference would do to Islam if he did not take any action. When a power takes all the capacities of a community or some communities under control and acts tyrannically, if the men of truth do not oppose him, refuting his actions, they have actually endorsed his actions. That is, oppression is endorsed by the men of truth, without them really wanting it. This was a sin committed by the elites from among the Bani Hashim and the children of the prominent figures of the early years of Islam. Imam Hussein, however, would not tolerate it, and hence he rose up. It is narrated that after Imam Sajjad returned to Medina from Karbala, maybe 10 or 11 months passed between the time this caravan left Medina and returned. A person visited him and said, O son of the Messenger of Allah, you see, you went and what happened? He was right. The caravan had left while Imam Hussein, the bright son of Ahlul Bayt, so much loved by the Messenger of Allah, was among them, leading them. The daughter of Imam Ali had left while she was dignified and honored. The children of Imam Ali, Abbas and others, the children of Imam Hassan, prominent and talented youth of Bani Hashim, had all left with this caravan. But the caravan returned with only one man, Imam Sajjad, with the women gone through sufferings of captivity and loss of their loved ones.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لاتشان.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان. أنا لاتشان.
Imam Hussein, Ali Akbar, even the baby were now gone. Imam Sajjad answered that man, stating, imagine what would have happened if we had not gone. Yes, if they had not gone, their bodies might have survived, but the truth would have died. The soul would have died out. Consciences would have been shattered. Logic and reason would have been condemned throughout history, and even the name of Islam would not have remained.
An international scandal has erupted after Pegasus, a weapons-grade piece of software used to hack and spy on mobile phones, has been found on the phones of journalists, lawyers, opposition figures, and potentially some of the world's biggest leaders. NSO Group, the Israeli company that manufactures and sells Pegasus, denies these allegations and claims it only sells software to vetted governments for counterterrorism and national security purposes. However, new research by a group of 17 media outlets called Project Pegasus shows an entirely different story. And this unregulated weapon has been used to illegally target, spy, and in some cases, murder journalists and dissidents. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On July 18th, 2021, news broke of a major phone hacking scandal involving the mobile phones of journalists and some of the world's most prominent politicians. A series of stories were published by Project Pegasus, a collaboration between outlets such as The Wire, The Guardian, and PBS, showing how countries like Mexico, the United Arab Emirates, and Morocco had all purchased an Israeli-manufactured spyware called Pegasus in order to hack the phones of government critics and political opponents. In collaboration with Forbidden Stories, Amnesty International, and researchers at Citizen Lab in Canada, these media organizations went through a list of over 50,000 phone numbers suspected to be victims of the Pegasus spyware. Over 80 journalists working in 10 countries pieced together this puzzle, putting names to numbers, and then went through the arduous process of asking suspected victims to provide their phones for forensic analysis. Traces of Pegasus were found on the phones of numerous journalists, some of whom worked at the very same outlets breaking the story. The investigation identified 180 journalists in 20 countries purported to have been selected for potential targeting, in addition to the phone numbers of French President Emmanuel Macron, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan, former Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri, and Morocco's King Mohammed VI. Emblematic of the scope of this release, a headline in the Washington Post that read, quote, "On the list, 10 prime ministers, 3 presidents, and a king." Needless to say, this immediately caused international outrage after learning that his phone, along with those of 14 other French government officials, had been potentially compromised. French President Macron immediately convened a national security meeting, and that was followed by an announcement from the chief of the EU Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, calling the hacking completely unacceptable. And of course, this isn't the first time Pegasus is in the news either. Perhaps the most infamous incident involving the Israeli spyware was its use in the murder of the Saudi journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi. In February of this year, the United States Office of the Director of National Intelligence, led by Avril Haines, issued a report in which it found that the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, was behind the murder of Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in late 2018. Now, while the DNI report didn't specifically mention Pegasus, it did implicate the entourage and personal security detail of MBS in the killing of the U.S.-based Washington Post columnist. It was long suspected that Pegasus had been used to track Khashoggi's movements in the lead-up to his murder. We now have the hard evidence to back this up. Using the latest forensics, Project Pegasus was able to scan the phones of Khashoggi's fiancée and wife and uncover traces of the spyware on both of their phones. An older report also showed that Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos had his phone hacked just a few months prior to the murder, around the same time as Khashoggi's wife, in 2018. It's alleged that MBS hacked his phone by sending him something over WhatsApp, and the connection here being that Jeff Bezos had bought the Washington Post, the very paper for which Khashoggi wrote before he was murdered. Pegasus was then again in the news, involving another incident in late 2020, when Citizen Lab discovered that 36 journalists at Al Jazeera had had their phones infected with it. Now, Pegasus can be deployed on both iPhones and Androids, and basically works just like a jailbreak or root. It bypasses iOS or Android security and gives the attacker access to the root file system. The attacker can then turn on the microphone, the camera, track the victim's location, see their files, photos, videos, and contacts. It gives them complete access and control, the ramifications and dangers of which are obvious to all. Now, what makes Pegasus so dangerous is that it doesn't even require the user to do anything. In some versions, people would be targeted by a phishing attack. They'd receive an SMS or an email which looked legitimate, saying, for example, that a package was being delivered to them. They'd click on the link, and then their phone would be infected. Now, Facebook, which owns WhatsApp Messenger, sued NSO Group for using an exploit in WhatsApp to deploy their spyware. The victim would do nothing. They would simply receive a missed call on WhatsApp, and their phone would be infected. Now, however, there are versions of Pegasus that are completely zero-click, which don't require any user interaction, and also whose execution cannot even be seen. Everything happens in the background. Another very frightening aspect of Pegasus is its persistence. In some versions, once the phone was hacked, simply turning off the device and turning it back on would be enough to shut down the hack, at least until a new infection. However, new evidence shows that persistent versions of Pegasus do exist, which penetrate so deeply inside the phone's security that the phone remains hacked even after rebooting the device. This, just like the various attack vectors and exploits, can vary from version to version, and there's no real way of knowing. Joining me is independent journalist Kabir Agarwal. He has written for The Times of India, Al Jazeera, and is now with The Wire, which is one of 17 publications involved in Project Pegasus. Thank you so much for coming on the program, Kabir. It's really a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you for calling me and for your interest in the subject.
Kabir, your publication, The Wire, is one of 17 who are part of Project Pegasus, and you guys have been doing fantastic work. Some of your own colleagues are in this list of people that were targeted by Pegasus. The founding editor, M.K. Venu, Bharat Darajan, your diplomatic editor, I mean, what was your guys' reaction when you found out this shocking news? And how did it feel for you also to be in the middle of it as you were at this conference in Paris on behalf of The Wire?
Yeah, I mean, the first time that The Wire learned of this was through when they found out, when these people find, when the founding editors and the diplomatic editor found out that they were themselves on the list. And they actually also went in for the forensic analysis of their phones, and infections were found on the phones of the founding editors. So I think they were shocked. They were not surprised. They were not surprised because they tend to expect this to be the case, that somebody is listening. That is the sad reality of India today, that journalists who are just doing their job expect a certain level of surveillance. So that wasn't surprising for them. I happened to be in Paris for the meeting which happened in May, where representatives of all the publications were there to just to figure out how to move forward with what we have, and also just to get clarity on what it is that we have and how we present this, the publication schedules, coordinating between 17 media houses from different parts of the world. And they have different audiences, they have different ways of presenting the news as well. So just deciding on embargoes and on the publication schedules, that happened in Paris. So it was very intense in that week, because we got this, all the media partners were introduced to the list or the database that the Forbidden Stories had. And that is the time when we first saw it. And that is also the time when we then quickly had to decide, because we couldn't also wait a very long time because of there was a risk of leak. So we had to publish quickly, which was a challenge because we had to do a lot of reporting in a very short period of time and across borders. And due to COVID in India, the COVID situation in India was very, very bad at that time. So it was challenging from that perspective as well. But we finally managed to. But the work is ongoing.
And, you know, this news about Pegasus, it's caused a real uproar in India. And it's been reported that numerous opposition figures were also among those who had their phones hacked. I mean, could you maybe break down for the viewers exactly how big of an impact this news has had in India and the consequences that have unfolded in politics and the media?
So this has had a huge impact in India. Perhaps the level of opposition to this in India has been... And it's still ongoing because it's been more than 3 weeks now, and that there is continuous disruption of India's parliament due to this, because the opposition parties are demanding that the government discuss this on the floor of the house in India's parliament, which is the temple of India's democracy. And it has had that kind of impact also because I feel that India stands out in the list of countries which are clients or which we understand to be clients of NSO Group, because the other countries are either authoritarian or semi-authoritarian regimes. India is looked at by the world as the world's largest democracy, and that is the image of India, and that is also how India has been a functioning or thriving democracy for a long time. That has changed slightly in the last 6 or 7 years. But that is still it's still not written in stone that you cannot still call India authoritarian or a semi-authoritarian regime. And for this kind of surveillance to take place in India, that is a big issue for most Indians who understand this, who have access to this information, and also the opposition parties. And the news stories landed on the day that the Indian Parliament began its monsoon session, as it's known during the monsoon period. And this entire session, the opposition has been demanding that the government have a discussion on this. And the government has been refusing to have a discussion, to even talk about it, which is why there has been a disruption of parliament. The Supreme Court, India's top court, has heard the issue. It will continue to hear the issue. So there are deep rumblings going on in India, primarily because amongst the list of countries, it is the only thriving democracy or somewhat thriving democracy.
You know, NSO, they responded to these allegations, to this, you know, very good reporting that you guys have done, and they said that everything is baseless, and they said that this list of numbers compiled by Forbidden Stories was apparently public information. I mean, what did you make of their response to these bombshell revelations that you've just uncovered?
Actually, their response on day one was a bit confused. They were a bit confused because they were probably not expecting this. Then their lawyers got together and sent some letters which were quite threatening, where all of this was included, that this is baseless and this is publicly available information, which it is not, because we have been able to confirm through different sources, through different techniques. So one of the main techniques that we've used, which is the forensic analysis which the Amnesty International team has done, is able to find the Pegasus infection on phones. And it works primarily on iPhones so far, because that is just the nature of the software, that Androids do not maintain detailed logs of the activity on the phone like iOS does. So it's easier to identify infections or Pegasus-related activity. And this methodology, which is used by Amnesty International, has been vetted and has been peer-reviewed by Citizen Lab, which has been at the forefront of these forensic analysis in the past as well, which did it for WhatsApp, and WhatsApp revealed that it's a vulnerability in WhatsApp was used to hack several phones around the world. So the methodology of Amnesty International is rock solid, and that is what we can base on, that so many phone numbers which appear in this list have forensic analysis proved that there is infection on these phones. And there would be infections on the Android phones as well, but it's just that we have not been able to find it because of the way the software is going. Maybe in the future, they will be better equipped to find those infections as well. But so those are some of the reasons why we can certainly say that this list is real, and it's not publicly available either.
Is it correct that they've engineered Pegasus in a way that it can delete its own tracks, so it can remove the evidence that it's even infected the phone in the first place, right?
Correct, yeah. It's getting smarter. So the latest, what the Amnesty's tech team has been telling us is that they see these processes which are essentially deleting tracks of Pegasus activity on the phone. Because now NSO has known for a time, because Citizen Lab has been doing analysis. So they have now been also actively trying to delete traces of Pegasus activity. So it's possible that we may not find Pegasus activity on a phone because all the traces have been deleted. So yeah, that is happening too. And they are getting smarter. The people who are analyzing on the other side are also getting smarter. So it's a cat and mouse game in that sense on the tech part.
Kabir, the thing with NSO Group is that the people who founded this company or work at this company, they're not the only ones making cyber weapons or military grade spyware. These are graduates of this Unit 8200, and you know, people, they've talked about this sort of pipeline between this Unit 8200 in the Israeli forces and this cyber weapons industry and companies like NSO Group. Is there something else that we know about other companies, or could you maybe tell us more about this so-called pipeline between the Israeli forces and this private sector, this industry?
I mean, I have not done much reporting on Israel and the links there, so I don't know much. I mean, the colleagues who worked with Haaretz in Israel, they have done some excellent reporting on this. And I mean, yes, there is that link, and I mean, there is essentially very little separation between, I mean, the Israeli government is also involved, right? So the Haaretz has done this reporting that it was also used like a diplomatic tool, right? So by Netanyahu. So wherever Netanyahu went, NSO went with him, or other Israeli defense equipment also went with him. So these sales were being made, even in the case of India. Prime Minister Modi visited Israel in July of 2017, and it's around that time that we see the first selections being made of potential targets in India. Around the time, so Netanyahu and Modi were walking hand in hand on the beach, And in the background, there are teams who were working on this. So we see that Israel has, I mean, at least Netanyahu at least used it in that sense as well. But I mean, there is excellent reporting being done by Haaretz on that.
There's a speculation going on that you know, Israel would never sell this weaponry without being able to know what it's used for, because the claim by NSO is that they have no idea what it's used for once they sell it, and they can't confirm whether it's been used to target journalists or not, or, you know, they say that they have nothing to do with it. Is that true? I mean, surely the Israelis must know what it's being used for. Do you think there's a possibility that they can use Pegasus to watch what the customer is doing with it?
Yeah, I mean, this is a big question which we've only heard contradictory responses from NSO about this. On the one hand, they claim that they have no control over it. They don't know how their software is being used. On the other hand, they also say that they are sure that their software is not being used for human rights violations. So both of these cannot be true, right? And they've also in the past, there are certain cases which they've said they have pinpointed that these people have not been targeted using Pegasus. But if they have sold their software and they do not have access to what their clients are doing, how do they know that these people have not been targeted? Right? So they must know. And this is a tricky situation, because the impression that the clients may have also may be that NSO does not know what the client is doing. And this must not be a very easy situation for the client country to be in either. If it knows that NSO has access to what the client has access to, and that in effect could perhaps mean that the Israeli government has access to what the client has access to, and that would be a major security threat, as some opposition leaders in India have pointed that out, that if the Israeli government has access to, and this is serious sensitive information, even if it's being used for anti-terrorist activities in India, and why would the Indian security agencies want that the Israeli government have access to that information? NSO has not been able to conclusively answer this question. On the hand, they claim that they don't have access. On the other, they claim that there is no human rights violation. So we don't know.
Just as a last question, Kabir, a two-part question. Do you think we're going to be seeing more of these revelations in the future? And what can people do to protect themselves from such things?
I'll answer the second question first. I don't think there is a lot people can do to protect themselves from such a thing as of now. I mean, one thing we were told initially was that if you have an iPhone, you should switch off FaceTime and iMessage. I don't know if that is any longer true, because I think Apple has come up with a security patch which patches the vulnerabilities which were being used latest. But there will be new vulnerabilities, new zero-day targets which hackers will find. So I don't know if there is anything. I don't think there is anything which users can do. Just keep updating your phone regularly. Perhaps that's it. And in the future, yes, I think that there would be more revelations. More and more people are coming forward, so our work is not over. We are analyzing phones, because now people are confident. So initially, when we approached some people, they did not want to go through the forensic analysis process. But now that the stories have been revealed and the scale and scope of this has been revealed, people know. So more people are coming forward. We are doing more forensic analysis every day. And we did take a bit of a break for a week or so, but now we are back and they are back working on it. So more revelations will come, for sure.
Well, keep up the fantastic work, the great reporting. Kabir Agarwal, thank you so much for coming on the program. Really such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks, Richard. Great talking to you as well.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now, what's interesting about the entire Pegasus affair isn't just the spyware itself, but the history behind the company, too. NSO Group, the Israeli manufacturer, was founded by graduates of Unit 8200, an intelligence and cyber spy agency in the Israeli forces. The thing is, we're not just talking about one company or one piece of spyware here. The Israelis have an entire pipeline of former spies and analysts who leave this unit and others similar to it and then use their knowledge and skills to go form companies which specialize in cyber weapons and cybersecurity. Haaretz reports in 2018 that 700 companies founded by 2,300 Israelis, 80% of whom had come from intelligence units in the Israeli occupation forces, notably Unit 8200. Now, of course, it's true that the Israelis like to exaggerate the allure and mystery around this unit in order to make it seem very special and elite. You'll hear of Unit 8200 mentioned in movies and TV shows, which is part of a marketing gimmick to make the Israelis seem exceptional. Nevertheless, there is some truth to the idea that a pipeline exists between their intelligence units, the military, and cyber weapons industry. Spyware, just like Pegasus, cannot even be sold without the knowledge and consent of Israeli politicians. This shows you that there is a clear link between the cyber weapons industry and the Israeli occupation, which not only trains these founders in the first place, but then helps them export their hacking tools and weapon systems. And if the Western world claims to support democracy and human rights and freedom of press, then it cannot continue to support Israel as it exports tools that are used to target journalists, political opponents, and human rights advocates. This is the antithesis of democracy. Western nations cannot continue to allow Israel to sell spyware that is so overwhelmingly dangerous and used to target dissidents, journalists, and activists. This goes against everything the United States, Great Britain, France, and its allies claim to stand for. It's also important to keep in mind that the things we discover and learn about things like Pegasus are usually outdated by the time we find out about them. And if you think that a commercialized cyber weapon like Pegasus is scary, just imagine what the NSA, GCHQ, and other intelligence agencies are able to do. Now, another major controversy that emerged at the same time as these Pegasus revelations is Apple's plans to scan the phones of its users. Apple claims that in order to fight child abuse, it wants to scan all the images its users upload on iCloud, comparing their hashes with the database provided by the police and the government. Edward Snowden, the former NSA analyst who leaked information exposing mass surveillance by the US government, expressed concern about this development. Apple is seeking to implement this feature in iOS 15. And the thing is, who gets to decide what's in the hash database? Who's to say the United States government won't include photos of classified documents in there and then jail anyone who's found to have matching photos on their devices, including whistleblowers and journalists? The possibilities and dangers that this poses are endless. Now, something amusing you might hear people say online is, how could we do this? These are overwhelmingly Western governments and corporations engaging in these unfettered practices of mass surveillance and are accountable to no one. And the fact of the matter is that Western governments cannot continue to support Israel's war crimes and certainly not its cyber weapons industry. The responsible thing to do would be to ban the sale of such cyber weapons and pressure any entity developing such armaments to cease immediately and entirely. But sadly, many countries that claim to be democracies are engaged in these very practices of mass surveillance, censorship, and putting journalists and whistleblowers in jail. Just look at Julian Assange, look at Chelsea Manning, or even Daniel Hale, who was sentenced just a few weeks ago for exposing the United States' horrific drone program. And given these explosive revelations of tools used to spy on, blackmail, and even kill journalists, with an entire industry dedicated to the development and sale of cyber weapons, you know, this isn't the first time that Pegasus has made the headlines, and why it certainly won't be the last. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
The UK government came under immense fire today after MPs condemned the catastrophic British failures in Afghanistan. During Wednesday's parliamentary debate on the subject, Boris Johnson desperately attempted to convince MPs that Britain's withdrawal wasn't chaotic at all, but with little success.
Mr. Speaker, I think it would be fair to say that the events in Afghanistan have unfolded and the collapse has been faster than I think even the Taliban themselves predicted. What is not true is to say that the UK government was unprepared or did not foresee this.
Before the debate even started, anti-war Labour MPs gathered outside Westminster with anti-war veteran Jeremy Corbyn to denounce British foreign policy.
Many of the MPs who have been supportive of the continued war and occupation in Afghanistan will be sitting today during this debate, which has already begun. Now, this will be very awkward for them, as many of the anti-war MPs who have criticised British foreign policy, particularly in Afghanistan for many, many years, have been proven right following the latest developments in Afghanistan.
British military failures was not the only focus of criticism. Concern over the lack of willingness to help Afghan refugees was expressed too. For the time being, the UK is refusing to recognise the Taliban's administration, but have agreed to accept some refugees, but only time will tell if Britain will honour this pledge or not. Robert Carter, London.
On the other side of Milak crossing point in east of Iran, the Taliban have taken down the Afghan flag and raised their own white flag, a move that represents their control of Afghan borders. This has given Iranians the jitters that Afghanistan's insecurity might spill into Iran. Since the conflict erupted in Afghanistan, Iran's border police have deployed more forces to its eastern borders to beef up security. Iran's border police say they constantly monitor the frontier and are ready to confront any hostile action along the border.
As you see, security is fully ensured here on our borders, and transit between the two countries is ongoing. Any suspicious movement along the border is monitored and will be nipped in the bud by our armed forces.
Over the past days, Iran's eastern border has been buzzing with Afghan refugees who are escaping from an uncertain future under the Taliban, who have now taken full control of the country after the central government collapsed. The majority of the fleeing Afghans have climbed a 50-kilometer concrete wall topped with barbed wire Iran erected more than a decade ago to block drug smuggling.
We embraced all the hardship and dangers to get to Iran. We walked for 4 days to get here.
I urge Iranian officials to let us stay here. In our country, there's no hope for peace and security. Otherwise, I wouldn't have left my homeland.
Iran's border police say they will peacefully return refugees who have made irregular crossings. Meanwhile, Iran has set up makeshift camps along the border to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees.
Based on religious teaching, we feel bound to serve our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. The Iranian armed forces accommodated them and provided them with food and medicine, and we hope they will find peace when they go back to their homeland.
Turkey has been building a 240-kilometer wall along its frontier with Iran to push back the fleeing Afghans. Last week, Pakistan has clashed with Afghan refugees at its border to hold them out, while Iran says it has been acting as a shield that limits the flow of Afghan migrants toward Turkey and Europe. It believes the situation cannot be solved with force, and collective measures need to be taken by world leaders to avert a refugee crisis.
While on the other side of this bridge, the conflict almost subsided. The influx of Afghan refugees still goes on. Iran's border police say they will continue to shelter Afghan refugees, hoping that Afghanistan will soon be a safe place for its people. Yusuf Jalali from Milak, Crossing Point, on the Iranian-Afghan border.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and German Chancellor Angela Merkel held talks in the Kremlin. This is their last summit meeting as heads of state because Merkel will not participate in the upcoming parliamentary elections in Germany. Her farewell visit took place on the anniversary of the alleged poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
Despite the fact that we have different opinions, I think it is good that we talk to each other and we intend to keep in touch further.
After the meeting with the Russian president, Merkel called on Putin to release Navalny. Putin, however, said the fight against corruption should not be used as an instrument of political struggle, adding the opposition figure was convicted not for his political activities, but for criminal offenses against foreign partners. The two also touched upon the situation in Afghanistan. Putin said Moscow's priority is to prevent terrorists from entering neighboring countries under the guise of refugees.
We know Afghanistan, and we know how this country is organized and how counterproductive it is to try to impose unusual forms of government and public life on it. Any such socio-political experiments have never been successful and led only to the destruction of states, degradation of their political and social systems.
In addition to bilateral relations, the fight against the coronavirus pandemic, the conflict in eastern Ukraine, the situation in Belarus, as well as Nord Stream 2 and the role of Ukraine as a transit country for Russian gas were discussed.
Merkel managed to defend the Nord Stream. The Americans pressed on her. Germany needs Russian energy. Regarding the situation in Afghanistan, here Germany fully listened to what the Americans were saying, and now Germany has received it in full. The Americans are living in an ugly way, having substituted all their allies in the NATO alliance. This once again showed that Germans that it's absurd to rely on the US. America's visit shows that the stake on in America is doubly wrong, and Germany during the reign of Merkel has repeatedly succumbed to influence from overseas.
On August 22nd, Merkel will fly to Kyiv. Putin asked her to influence the country's authorities to fulfill all obligations on Donbas.
Berlin has always been one of Moscow's main partners in politics and economics. The Russian president expressed hope that with the new leadership in Germany, in the near future, it would be possible to continue the dialogue on resolving the conflict in southeastern Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish Foreign Minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan.